Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. This is Doyle Shamley here in Eager, Arizona. Now, again, this is a very special show this evening, so make sure to have your writing instruments and paper ready. You're going to want to take notes, and due to the special content of the show, for your donation purposes for the audio recording of the show, we have lowered the price, $8 for non-Hot Club members, $5 for Hot Club members, postage paid for tonight's show only. Now, if you'd like to write the Hour of the Time, it is Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona 85925. If you'd like to visit our website, it's a massive website full of research materials and articles and news updates. It is hourofthetime.com. Again, that's hourofthetime.com. And if you'd like to either email myself or Robert, the co-host and webmaster, the link is right at the top of the page, and my direct one, of course, is hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, this evening, our special guest, we have to make tonight's show as unbiased and professional as possible. We have intentionally never spoke to each other till about 2 hours ago for about 3 minutes to do a phone check and sound level check, and then about 3 minutes ago to get linked together. We have also not shared any of our research material with this gentleman so that it is a completely unbiased view of the case of the autopsy of Bill Cooper. Now, this gentleman, his name is Craig. Here is his background, if you will, CV, defense investigator since 1980, founding member of the Professional Association of Wisconsin Licensed Investigators, two-term board of directors, one-term secretary, vice president of operations, Great Lakes Loss Prevention, has worked over 500 homicide cases, psychology instructor, Western Wisconsin Technical College, Tomah, Wisconsin. His education consists of 4 semesters in the medical doctorate program, MUA, studied neuropsychological assessment, University of Wisconsin, clinical psychology, Cardinal Strittich University, Milwaukee, criminal justice, Northern Arizona University, a BA in psychology, Lakeland College, Sheboygan, Wisconsin, minor in criminal justice, biology, chemistry, and theology, as well as numerous training certificates. Craig, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, Craig. And I think that took care of your background. Was there anything else that you wanted to add?
No, that's pretty much it.
Okay. And, Craig, maybe explain to the audience, because I do want them to understand that we intentionally have kept this as open-minded as possible, your research in this, so maybe relay the story of how you even started this, but the little thing you're telling me.
And here at school, and I have had a long interest in shortwave. And I was talking with a girl on campus about my interest in shortwave, and she had asked me if I had ever heard of Bill Cooper. And I said, sure, I heard the show a couple times on BCQ. My favorite show on BCQ was John Lightning. So I'm just a DXer. I mean, I'm not a fan. I just like to make the contacts. So she asked me to look at the site, and she had heard about the homicide. So I went in there, looked at the site, pulled the autopsy, and from what little I had heard over the shortwave with respect to Bill's death, I found that the autopsy did not support the story that was being told by the officials.
Yes. And then that at that point, we began contacting via email.
Correct.
And they were basically short exchanges. We never really spoke of any findings per se, just really technical terms like the definition of stippling and ranges, things like this, which I have printed out right here with me. And that was really our only contact. Now, I guess where we should, where do you want to start with your side of your investigations, Craig?
Well, I'd like to just start with the beginning of the autopsy.
Okay.
Report. Couple things here that we just get out of the way. Before having to go to the actual trauma injuries. You know, Bill was not really the specimen of health here. I mean, he had a fatty liver, and that's going to pretty much show that, you know, he had a bit of a drinking problem. And he had hypertrophy of the heart, which suggests he had compensated heart failure.
Mm-hmm.
And by heart failure, I don't mean it's an acute situation, it's long-lasting, and it can go on for years.
Yes.
So I would say he probably had another 5-6 years to live.
Yes.
At the most here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before getting into the actual protocol of the autopsy, we need to understand what's going on here at this crime scene.
Yes.
And we have Bill Cooper, who knows about weapons, who's an experienced combat veteran, injured in war. So he knows how to be in a gunfight.
Yes.
And we have several trained police officers, and Arizona, from my experience, has very good training for law enforcement. So it's not a bunch of cowboys out there just shooting it up. Here's people who know what's going on and have been in the situation before, which makes some of the findings a little difficult to explain.
Yes.
So.
And where would you like to start with those, or do you want to go a little more background first?
Well, I'd like to just go through the report as it is.
Okay.
The first two pages are just the pathological findings.
Yes.
So what the doctor who did the, his name is Peters, did the autopsy found. He found damage to the chest, damage to the head, one shot in the leg, one shot in the arm, and then the other medical stuff, which talks about his missing leg.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to the opinion that the death was due to gunshot. And I don't think there's any way that anyone could dispute that.
Yes.
I mean, it's very obvious.
Yeah.
So we get into the third page on this where it talks about there's 35 millimeter photographs taken, fingerprints, and x-rays. Now, I would really like to see these x-rays. I don't know if I ever asked you for them or not, but those would be quite telling about angles and whatnot.
No, we hadn't. We pretty much just traded definitions back and forth, that's all.
Right. So when you get into page 4 is where I find the first thing that is somewhat confusing to me. And it means that the decedent is received within a sealed black plastic body bag.
Mm-hmm.
Within the bag is a folded blue body bag and an additional white body bag containing the deceased.
Mm-hmm.
The head and hands are bagged.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have never seen 3 body bags used to transport somebody. Now, I understand it's a distance between Eager and Tucson, so that might explain 2 bags, but not this third bag. It's, I don't know what it points to, but it's certainly unusual.
Uh-huh.
The other thing I've never seen in an autopsy is I've never seen a head bag. The hands are routinely bagged.
Yes.
But I've never seen a head bag.
Uh-huh.
So this is well after the death, so I don't think it's really meaningful. We get over to the general examination of the external portion of the body. The doctor looked at it. Well, he's pretty good health. Noted the images from just an external view. It's a cursory view. They just look at it and tell you what they see.
Yeah. Scars.
But as I'm going through the next portion where it talks about clothing and belongings, I don't see any pants listed. It talks about brown socks or white socks, some brown and blue boots, some gloves that are in a pocket, a comb, two sets of keys, a knife, one yellow tan sock covering the left knee, you know, where the amputation was.
Yeah.
And a black belt with a brown holster at the right side. So this missing pants, and additionally a wallet, and there's no money with them, is sort of interesting in as much as that, from my understanding of what occurred, he was on his way into town or coming back and driving his truck. Certainly he would have had some money with him in case he wanted to buy some gas, some beer, whatever. And his wallet, people normally take that. So
well,
this I just find really strange.
Actually, he was in bed. So when he would have gotten up, he would have put his pants on. He kept them on the left side of his bed by his nightstand. He would then sit on the edge of his bed, take off his prosthesis. I know, I took care of him. And then he left his pants there in like a fireman's type position so he could just, again, sit up, spin around, pull them on over his prosthesis because that was kind of a hassle, and then go and do whatever. Also should be noted that when I requested the wallet, because some of the contents were confidential, and I had just seen what was in the wallet that day at lunch when I visited with him. We had lunch, and I went down to pay a couple bills in town for us. Besides crucial numbers that him and I shared that were in his wallet, and I wanted to get them back, were several hundred dollars because we were putting money aside to do research at a site in New Mexico, and we needed travel money. And when I requested the effects on his body, I was denied categorically around with different excuses. The keys were lost, so I had to find someone to rekey everything, like the truck and stuff, okay, so we could move it. Which was ironic because then they admitted that they used the truck headlights for lighting in the area, and that's what explained the dead battery in it. And I did find the light switch on, but the key's gone. And the wallet contents, when I was initially offered, finally, the possessions, and then when asked why I wanted the clothes, well, for nitrate testing, for close range exchange of gunfire, nitrate would be evident on the cloth, then I was completely shut off and never received any of the stuff, including the confidential numbers and all that, which were in his wallet, which were in his pants, which he would have been wearing. Okay.
Nitrates and barium and antimony would also be found.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, antimony, because it's used in the mixture when they for the hardness levels of bullets, and also the priming compound. I just want to stick that in there so everybody's clear, step by step. Okay.
Right.
Okay. Now what next, Craig?
We get to therapeutic procedures.
Yeah.
And it's a one-word description. None.
Yeah.
So, viewing his injuries, there was nothing anybody could have done. But you still would have thought that they would have tried something. Some EMTs. Unless it was so clear that he was dead that there was nothing you could do. And that may not be very apparent from the outside.
Uh-huh. So basically, I guess what you're saying is when the law enforcement personnel involved right then on the scene stated that he was dead before he hit the ground, and that there was, and then kept the paramedics away, that that wasn't a wise decision?
Well, if it was dead before it hit the ground, what would be the harm in letting the paramedics get there and take care of them?
Yes, exactly.
And when you say dead before you hit the ground, what do you mean by dead?
Yeah, I'm just telling you what...
Because there's a time between the infliction of the injury which causes the death and the actual death.
Yes. And do you think in a place where I know had only one small light bulb for the whole property, no street lights, nothing, one of our worst monsoon storms of the year and continued all day the following day, or that day, the 6th, that a street cop, law enforcement person, would be able to make that call? And would that be normal when there was no coroner on site either? Is that normal to make the call, he's dead before he hit the ground, so stay away, you don't need to bother with him?
I would certainly think that's inappropriate.
Okay. All right.
I mean, you'd want a second opinion.
Well, I would think.
And how is it that you know he was dead?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unless, I mean, the answer could be explained in as much as maybe they know more than they're telling you.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, that'd be down the story, so sorry. We want to make sure it's clear again.
Which one of the wounds that we're going to talk about in a little bit could explain that statement?
Yes. Okay.
So the first one, which is discussed, is some blunt impact injuries to the head and extremities. I looked at these on the autopsy, and they're pretty indescript. They could have come from just falling over face first into the gravel or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think that there might be another cause there, but I haven't seen pictures of him, so it'd be hard for me to make an estimation of what the cause was. But the pathologist does list them as blunt impact injuries to the head.
Yeah.
The first gunshot wound is one to the upper left chest, which is examined. This is kind of interesting. It wasn't a fatal injury. I mean, he could have walked away from this one. I don't know where in the sequence this came from, whether it was shot 1, 2, 3, or 9.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do know is that it came from his right side. The tracking of the bullet is from right to left.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, it passes through part of the chest. I don't think it went into the actual chest cavity. So we're talking about getting into the muscles of the pectoralis muscles and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it lodges in the triceps.
Mm-hmm.
The medical examiner puts the comment here, which says, for the bullet to have this path, the upper left extremity must have been raised. So an argument could be made that he was, holding the pistol with both hands and firing at them. It's conceivable.
Mm-hmm.
But that is inconsistent with the story that I was told over the different media shortly after this happened, that he was running from them.
Yes.
And he would not be in that position.
No.
So this really needs some more examination.
Yeah, and that's
or explanation.
And also the law enforcement from the scene, that was what they reported, running, firing backwards, as if your arm is slung out sort of behind you to your right side, firing as he's running forward.
Right. Now that behavior there does not suggest somebody who's a combat veteran. somebody who's in that position getting fired at is going to take deliberate shots because he knows the limitation of his gun. He knows how many bullets he has. He's going to utilize what he has effectively. He's not going to make wild shots like that to get him some time to move.
Yeah.
And I also find it a little strange that a man with one leg was running.
Yeah. I saw him hobble pretty fast once, but never run. That was just when one of the girls took a spill on a rock in the yard.
So we get into what's the page six.
Mm-hmm.
Gunshot wound to torso number two. This probably would have been fatal. Passes through, leaves a big hole. A significant amount of hemorrhage in there. But it wasn't as immediate as gunshot number three, which is the right chest.
Uh-huh.
It's the most telling part about it is this. The bullet then passed into the pericardial sac, perforating the right ventricle 1/2 inch.
Uh-huh.
The bullet then passed through the septum to exit the lateral left ventricle through a 2-inch defect.
Uh-huh.
This wound itself, the right ventricle pumps blood into the lungs. So with that gone, you're not getting any blood into the lungs.
Uh-huh.
From there, it goes back to the left atrium, and then into the left ventricle, to the aorta, and out to the rest of the body. So, with both of these ventricles gone, if there is any contractility of the heart left, the blood is just going to be squirting into the chest cavity, which we see due to the fact that there's a significant hemothorax there.
Yeah.
With it. And you're going to have minimal blood getting into the rest of the body. And this is what killed him. He had seconds of consciousness left after that.
Uh-huh.
Now, what makes this important is not that that wound happened, but when we get over to page 8, are you following me?
Yeah.
Gunshot wound to the head?
Yeah.
This is the, when I read this is where I realized more happened there than what the official story is.
Yes.
And I underlined a sentence in here which says, a periphery of stippling is present and measures from 1 1/2 inches posterior to 5 inches inferior medially. Okay, so in order for stippling to occur,
yes,
the gun has to be within 3 feet of the target, the person who's getting shot.
And as close as 6 inches.
Yes.
By definition.
And some people would hedge on the 6 inches. I mean, it could be even less than that.
Yes.
So if you look at the wound track on this, there's a 2-inch decline from where it enters the ear and lodges in the first and second vertebrae.
Uh-huh.
Now, there is a significant amount of hemorrhage in here. One of the things in here is the subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Uh-huh.
Now, not to make light of the situation, but that hemorrhage alone, the subarachnoid hemorrhage, would cause such pain that he would probably have gone unconscious from the pain or been unable to respond to any of the external environment because of the pain.
Yeah.
People who have these hemorrhages in a normal clinical setting will describe the pain as the worst headache they have ever had. So we have this person who's within 3 feet and standing at him, over him. So it would be, and there's no way to be certain as to what angles he was at, because none of us were there. But what I can say is this would be consistent as if he were on his knees and somebody was standing directly to his right within 3 feet over him with the barrel pointing down and firing at him within that distance. Now, a trained law enforcement officer is not going to get within that close a distance to shoot somebody who has a gun. They're going to be looking for cover, making sure of their safety. They're not going to walk up to a person who's armed and get in that distance and fire on them.
Uh-huh.
And that is the most interesting thing of the entire autopsy here.
Especially when you consider the range. If it, you know, by definition, as close as 6 to 8 inches.
Right.
And there again, by definition, sometimes even if it was contact, there'd be muzzle burn.
Right.
But, so, safe to say, leaning on conservancy, 3 feet to as close as 6 inches.
Right, somewhere in that range.
Mm-hmm.
And
had to be higher than his head also,
correct.
Which means since he was so tall, they would either have been firing from the sky or he would have had to have been on the ground.
Kneeling would be...
Kneeling, yeah.
But there could be other explanations for the positioning of the body, but it is consistent with that.
Yeah.
And due to the amount of blood that was in this wound, it is my opinion, as a fourth semester medical student, that this shot probably preceded the shots to the heart, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah, and that's due to...
Which damaged both ventricles.
Because it couldn't have pumped that volume of blood to the brain wound if the chest ventricle shot had been prior.
Correct.
Okay.
The heart's not pumping.
Yeah.
It may have been quivering a little bit, but it's not being effective.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this wound in and of itself would probably have been fatal eventually, but there were the vital structures within the brain which control the breathing and the heart rate and temperature were probably missed by that. So he could have conceivably had some life to him for I don't know how long. But I would guarantee that it probably rendered him immediately unconscious.
Okay.
And the fact that it hit his two vertebrae, his right side would have been paralyzed. If not, due to the impact and that would have happened there, and you would have gotten a spinal shock syndrome, probably not everything, the innervation, you know, the way the nerves communicate with the body, the muscles, would have probably knocked it right out. Additionally, he would have lost probably half of his vision due to the damage that was there, had he stayed conscious.
Yeah, Craig, just 1 second, please, okay? Okay. that wound would have stopped purposeful movements.
Absolutely.
Okay. But the heart is still pumping to get
right.
that blood there.
Right.
So it's pretty irrefutable that the shot to the head was before the shot that damaged the ventricles. So the shot to the that hit the ventricles and the chest would have been after all purposeful movements were ceased.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. And
now, I'm certain there would be people who would take issue with that, but that's not the way I'm reading it.
Okay.
There's certainly enough blood up there to suggest that there was a heart pumping.
Okay.
Another little thing that we would have seen here is he would have had, for the sake of argument, the spine was not damaged and he could move information through the spine. The cerebellar defects that happened there would have really made any movement, like a Parkinson's person, even
yeah.
worse. So that shot has all different aspects, different damage to different aspects of the brain, which each alone would have made him very difficult to deal with his environment in a meaningful way, and together would have been absolutely fatal.
Okay. And then...
And if we were to play this out, let's say they... the heart wound didn't happen, and this was the only wound, and they got medical treatment to him in time and got him to the hospital. He would have lived a day or two, maybe.
Uh-huh.
Provided that being the only wound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is clearly not the case.
Yes. Okay. Now, with the one of the... Another one discussed in the report. I think you wanted to... We want to go to that one now, or...
Which one would that be?
The thigh, or...
Yeah, that I just read over last night again, which is really quite interesting. I have no... I cannot put forth a reasonable scenario which this could have occurred. Here you have the bullet entering in the lower shin, and... tracking into the upper or the lower aspect of the thigh.
Yes.
And it's coming from below going into the thigh. I cannot see how he'd be positioned to let that happen. Unless he was laying on the ground or laying somewhere else and somebody walked up to him or got, they had to have been several feet away and then shot him that way.
Yeah, the thing though, because through the shin up into the thigh,
right,
and the path that not only would he have to be laying on the ground, that's really not that a drastic angle. So they would have had to have been quite low to the parallel surface of the ground, also,
right,
or the same,
or the surface that he was laying on.
Yes, that's what I mean. The basically the plane of his leg and their weapon would have had to have been pretty close in alignment.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And orientation, in fact, because of the path, as far
correct.
As north and south, east and west.
Mm-hmm. And as far as a proper law enforcement shot, I could not see where a trained law enforcement official would take that kind of shot. I mean, it just is not the type of thing that would do. All that would do is disable him.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to stop him from shooting.
Mm-hmm. Which, if he's just blatantly shooting at you, you obviously want to stop that.
Right. But how, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You're going to take your shots for the biggest area of the chest.
Mm-hmm.
Which the majority of the shots went through.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess also, one thing now that we've hit on all the, have we got, let me see here, have we gotten all nine?
Yeah, we've covered the majority of them.
Yeah.
There's one in the hand, raise the hand, a couple others that were really not factorial in his death. Or when a shooting happens with law enforcement personnel, the people who've studied it usually find that there's a lot of, I mean, everybody's just unloaded before they start thinking what's going on.
Yeah.
And that is, could explain the nine shots.
Mm-hmm. That
yeah, we don't have any idea of what, where else there's been shots that missed them.
Yeah, for the total amount. To
right.
Me. Yeah, and that is quite common in exchanges that there's just oodles, or basically the spray and pray tactic, or shoot till your magazine's empty.
Right.
This type of scenario, and
right.
That volume would all be dependent upon the make and model of gun you were carrying. What's interesting is, because of the close proximity due to stippling,
right.
And the fact that where he was positioned and lay, and the whole front of the house, including several windows, was right there,
mm-hmm.
And it's a very, the front was a rock facade. You could walk up with a hammer and hit it and make a big white chip on it.
Right.
The plywood, the metal door, which those are easy to chip with, is if you walked up, if you hit it with a hammer, you chip it and ding it. And the glass, as of course, we know what happens with that. There was no stray anywhere on the whole entire front of the house. Which would seem odd for the distance by the official story.
Right.
And the typical volume in a fire exchange that not one missed and hit the front of the house, when that was the only thing on the other side of them was the entire front of the house. No marks, no holes in plywood, no windows shot. And then the close proximity of the head wound would seem that they were, though the shots were very accurately fired. And to be that accurate and never hit anything else of the structure, it would almost appear that all of them were from very close. Not from clear across the yard just shooting high speed, because you would inevitably have to hit the pillars, the front porch, the glass, something else.
Well, yes. I mean, if there's a volume of shots fired, and they're facing the direction of the house, it's fairly likely one of them should have hit the house at least once.
Yeah, and considering he was about 6 feet from the front door, at the very edge or beginning of the covered front porch,
mm-hmm.
Which is about 6 feet wide or depth from the house, and direct alignment with the front door because he was trying to get inside. That's pretty evident. He was running for the front door. Since the whole background is massive, okay, you're talking a house, two-story at that, 6 feet from the person, any stray ones would have had to hit the home. Either that or stop somehow 6 feet short of the home. Okay, I think that we need to, we've said stippling a few times. And I think that it's only proper that we define that.
Okay.
All right. We have it in a couple different ballistics and forensics websites. Or is that something you just want to define right on the air, or I can, whatever?
I send them to the website.
Yeah. And I
have them. I think I sent you three or four of them.
Yeah, I've got them right here. And basically, what they say is, if a person goes to these two links, intermediate range, which is what we're talking about, 6 to 8 inches starting, out to 1.5 to 3.5 feet, is defined, this is too far for soot to travel, so there is no fouling, but hot fragments of burning propellant, which is the gunpowder, follow the bullet to the victim and produce stippling by causing pinpoint burns around the entrance wound. And one of the two types of propellant, ball and flake, which is actually, that's incorrect, because it's also extruded. But anyway, the former, which this is well-known, ball, will produce stippling at a greater distance. And that's simply because it's more aerodynamic in its shape, and it burns from the outside in. It stays essentially round to completion of burn, so it flies farther than flake. Now, when we get to close range, 6 to 8 inches, for instance, the entrance wound is surrounded by fouling and deposited on the skin, and there may also be stippling. Six inches to 1.5 to 3 feet, hot fragments of burning propellant or gunpowder again. Follow the bullet to the victim, produce stippling again by causing pinpoint burns around the entrance wound. So there is the definition of stippling, how it's caused, and the ranges where it's possible to have stippling. You can't have stippling from 30 feet away.
No.
Okay. And in fact, they even define the next one as distant, which is beyond 1.5 to 3.5 feet. They give that window.
Mm-hmm.
Actually cannot have fouling, stippling, soot, and the wounds are clean. And that can start as close as 1.5 feet. No stippling. So that's why that window's open clear down to 6 inches.
Right.
Because you can actually have no stippling and be still as close as 1.5 feet away.
Right.
Okay. We just, because the audience may have never heard that word even. Who knows? What else would you like to point out in your research of the autopsy report?
I think we pretty much covered all the major points.
Yes.
That we have talked about. At least everything that I've seen. Every time I go through it, I see something else new.
Yes, of course. And
I think this should do it.
Okay. Now, Craig, again, you've been... Oh, the line's getting dirty, Craig.
Okay.
You have been... Again, I want to verify here with you.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure I have this right. You've worked over 500 homicide cases. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And you're a defense investigator since 1980?
Right.
Okay. And you have a BA in psychology with your minors in criminal justice, chemistry, theology?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, how would you sum this up as far as from the standpoint of protocol in the legal system, like maybe how a complaint is filed or how it's done and how stories have to be the first story, the facts, not made to fit this or that? What would you think would be the logical outcome for an investigation of, let's say, this autopsy report or case? If charges were to be levied against someone, what charges would they be? Negligence or trespassing or what?
Well, trespassing would depend on whether they had a legitimate purpose in being there.
That was more satirical. Go ahead.
Yeah. I would definitely feel very comfortable saying that there should be a civil suit started for wrongful death at the very minimum. I'm not seeing any reason that this guy should have died like this. There's no need for somebody to come up within 3 feet and pull the trigger on somebody's head. There's just no reason for that. I could also see, theoretically, maybe some criminal homicide charges out of this.
Okay. And that's based on your experience over the years, working cases and your education?
Right.
Okay. Now, I know that you need a few other documents which are already on the way from a third party.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll be able to look at some of the other stuff that's been gathered up, statements and things like that.
Right.
After action reports. I say that's already on its way from a third party. So that will help you with further research. Again, that was withheld intentionally at this point, so you would be looking at the autopsy solely from a medical evidence standpoint,
mm-hmm.
a forensic standpoint. What else would you add looking at this, Greg? Your line is getting incredibly dirty. Are you on a landline or?
No, I'm on a mobile.
Yeah. What would you add, I guess, in summary also of what you've read? Is there anything else that needs to be pointed out for those who would have already read this report? It is, you know, on the site. It's available so that they can read it with more understanding or anything like that.
I would suggest get the report off the site, read it yourself, and make your own mind up as to what occurred.
Mm.
And compare the version, which is the official version, with what you see in the autopsy.
Okay. Now, Craig, these links that we use to get some of these definitions that, you know, you use in defining this, checking out any of these cases, they're not something you created.
No, I'm not very computer literate. I could...
this forensics path and the other one, at the tripod at Ballistics.
Right.
I think we're going to go ahead and post these also.
Right.
So that the members can see for themselves, and I'm not making up these definitions either. And do you have any suggestions for the listening audience, researchers, etc., as to other places to look for technical terms, anything they might stumble over reading this report? We're going to provide the definition and ballistics and stuff like that.
If you see a definition within the report, do a Google search and come up with what comes up on that and go to it yourself.
Uh-huh.
I mean, for me to limit the 2-3 sites that I know of certainly wouldn't do anybody any justice when they can do a Google search and come up with a greater number of sites and better information, maybe.
And there's also, of course, university libraries, public libraries, and such.
Right.
Yes. So people can check this out themselves if they want the verbatim, by the letter, black and white definition, and not even use your sources.
Correct.
Yes. Okay. And if they want to get the autopsy, of course, they can get it from Tucson Forensics if they don't even believe the one that's on the site.
Right.
So
I'm not real familiar with Arizona's open record law or Freedom of Information Act, what they have, but autopsies are pretty much open record in most of the 50 states that I'm aware of.
Yes, and I do know people who've written, and you get it for free, even. You got to pay the postage is all.
Mm.
And that's just, who knows, that could be whatever clerk you got as far as the post is concerned, but even the report was provided for free. So people can write the Tucson Forensics Lab and get that. Go to definitions from places that you did not use and research it totally on their own.
Right.
Okay, Greg, and the rest of what you and I need to arrange for the other package so you know what you're looking at, that there's no use wasting airtime on that, so we'll just do that off the air, because that's just a matter of addresses and when it's going to arrive and stuff.
Right.
And if you're picking it up because it's signing for it and stuff. But in conclusion, I think that you've done a vast amount of research, obviously, on this. And did you have help? Because this is all going to be questioned by people. You know, did you have help leaning you one way or the other from anybody else around you?
No, I just picked it up and looked at it, and based on my experience, I mean, it's not a real sophisticated death. I mean, it takes maybe 10 minutes research to see what's going on with the gunshots. Maybe the order of the shots is a little more complicated medically, but that's negligible.
Yeah.
I mean, I did run this past the pathology professor here. I had a look at it. He pretty much concurred with me.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, other than that, though, you didn't have somebody leaning over your shoulder telling you this, this, and this?
No.
Okay.
No, we, down here, we pretty much stick to our books.
Huh. And what, as far as you did mention, because someone will ask this, of course, also, either via email to me or something, the lady that first said, hey, did you hear about this, da-da-da, was she directing you in any way?
No.
Yeah.
Just to go take a look at it, it was more out of curiosity.
Yeah.
On her part.
Yeah. Okay.
She's a big Bill Cooper fan. She has 2 copies of his book, I think it's Behold a Pale Horse.
Okay. All right, well, that, just so it's clear to the audience, you weren't held, your hand wasn't held through this.
No. I would, you know, I've done plenty of these, and I, you know, I'm going to probably do plenty more.
Yeah. Okay. And I know that people are going to email me and call me and write me wanting to contact you, but we're going to keep your anonymity.
Okay.
At this point, I think it'd be better.
Right. Well, it's, you know, I would really enjoy hearing from a lot of people on this,
uh-huh.
or any case that I've worked. The point of the matter is, though, we only have so much time of the day.
Yes. If you wanted to use at least something to keep you quasi-private, like mm-hmm. email, do you want to put that out on the air?
Yeah. I have an email that I use specifically for medically related questions.
Okay.
And that's my last name, which is Pradarelli, Pradarelli, @hotmail.com.
Okay, I'm going to repeat that again. If someone wanted to write you concerning medical type questions or research questions, not your life history, that can be done at Pradarelli@hotmail.com. That's Pradarelli@hotmail.com.
Correct.
Okay. And other than that, though, you really don't need to be hassled. Because the day is
I certainly would enjoy talking to people. I really enjoy forensic pathology and...
Yeah.
I love talking about it, but only so much time in the day.
Yes, exactly. So we want to stress that to the audience. And then any other information is just going to be kept with us, mailing and all that. So
right.
don't bother asking me anybody. Okay, Craig, I want to thank you very much for your research on this, and... we will do the next step with you all after the said package, and that will lead you to the next step, I'm sure, in your research because of the questions you've raised yourself on the autopsy report.
Right.
I think it's going to help you put it all together a lot easier once you see that.
Okay.
And that's simply all public information also. It will not be contrived or biased by us. And again, available to the public if they want to check it out themselves.
Right.
There is fees for all that, though. And they can be fairly high, so expect that if you plan on getting all these documents, somebody out there. Okay, Craig. Again, thank you for your time and your research. You need to hold the line, okay?
Okay.
And everyone, you've been listening to Craig Gradarelli and his research and conclusions based on the autopsy reports. You've been listening to this, The Hour of the Time, and you can reach us at Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Our website is hourofthetime.com. The email links to contact either myself or Rob, co-host and webmaster, are both right at the top of the page when you open the site. Now you need to visit the site, do the research, check it out, everyone. You've been listening to Hour of the Time on WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, Monticello, Maine. And be sure to tune in for more exciting shows of the Hour of the Time, Monday through Thursday evenings, 10 Eastern. Thank you.